Welcome to the Productivity Mastery Podcast, presented to you by myself, Stoyan Yankov, productivity and performance coach, keynote and TEDx speaker, and co-author of the Perform Methodology, and the book Perform, the Unsexy Truth About Startup Success. Join me on a journey to discover what some of the world's leading professionals do to be more productive, create peak performing teams, and build successful global companies. New episodes weekly. And now, enjoy today's episode. Guten Morgen, Deutschland and the rest of the world.
Good morning, good morning.
Good morning, Niklas. Man. How are you doing? You had your coffee, I can see.
I have my coffee. It's, it's not super early for me. Usually I start a bit earlier, but it's rare that I have a podcast, right, with my coffee.
Yeah, thanks so much for making the time for the audience, for those of you who are tuning in right now. Niklas and I met at Web Summit last year. We were both speakers at Web Summit. I was actually emceeing the growth stage, the stage that is for so-called Soonicores, which I guess Niklas and his team is falling into in this kind of a definition. And we had a lot of fun in the backstage and we were discussing. Niklas, like, I got a feature in the podcast, brother. And he was like, yeah, let's make it happen. And now, what, like 8-9 months later?
It's almost again. It's going to be Web Summit, right? And I will be there again. I think you will be there again too. So
most likely. Cool. So kudos for Web Summit, for Brandon for connecting.
Thanks, Paddy. And Brandon. Yeah.
There you go. So those of you who are tuning in on LinkedIn, watching us live, first of all, let us know in the comments, where are you tuning in from? So we can see where you guys watch us from. But also, if you have any questions to Niklas, I will just make a short introduction just in a second. But we'll talk about entrepreneurship, we'll talk about cyber, and we'll talk about psychology, all topics Niklas is very excited about and I'm excited to learn. But this gentleman here has a fascinating personality, first of all. He's one of the most humble people that you can see. But if you have a look at his background, he has a PhD in philosophy, if I'm not confused. Was it philosophy or psychology?
It's business, actually, but a very psychological topic.
Okay. Yeah. So he has a PhD. He spent over 6 years in BCG, leading management consulting firm. One of the top in the world. If you ask him, he's probably going to say number one, but we're not going to go there. After which, he started his own company. And as of today, there are more than 350 people. They raised more than 76 million euro. And they're way on the way to transform the way we look at cybersecurity. So very excited to welcome you this morning, Niklas. How are you doing? And what's on your mind these days?
Thanks, Stoyan, and thanks for the very nice introduction. Obviously, I'm again humbled by such a nice introduction. And as you said, we are trying to change the perspective on cybersecurity by working with the people. And that's also why I'm, again, super excited to talk about psychology and security, because that's what we are combining at SoSafe.
Mm-hmm. I just want to shout out to the people who are joining us here. Jacqueline is joining us from London. Hello.
Hello, we have Momchil,
who's joining from Sofia, Bulgaria. Dobro utro, Momchil. And then we have Deutschland. Of course, we don't know who that is because it says LinkedIn user. But we know it's after.
Düsseldorf. our company is headquartered in Cologne, which is, let's put it that way, a befriended city of Düsseldorf. There's a little rivalry between them, but we all love each other.
Yes, of course, it's love at the end of the day. So I just want to start with you mentioned psychology, and I'm curious, how did you get into BCG, and what were the kind of projects that you were involved with? Is that psychology and business, or what did you do, and what did you learn from spending 6 years in BCG?
Yeah, I learned a lot. Obviously, 6 years is definitely beyond the average of a regular BCG-er. I think the average tenure is 4 years, and then people usually move on to new shores. I did that a little bit later. I went into consulting basically because at that point I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So psychology was something that was always very fascinating to me. Many facets of psychology. I was very interested in biopsychology, so there was also a slight chance that I could go into research. I was part of a research group that looked into schizophrenia and the outbreak of schizophrenia. But then, in the end, it was I realized I'm not a full-time researcher because it's you have to be like super detailed. You have to work on very small topics, and I wanted to pull some larger levers and maybe stay a little bit more on the high level. And then I realized that consulting would be something where I could do that, like see many different areas of business at the end or like in the beginning. I mean, obviously, I didn't have any clue about business. Then at a certain point, if you are a psychologist, there is some gravitation towards the people and organization practice at BCG. So that's where I went, and that's where I also spent most of my projects. So working with very big corporates, actually, large automotive manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies, and work on topics like, people development, culture, performance management, remuneration, like all these HR topics, many HR topics, and also training and development. That was something I spent a lot of time in, developing academies for large corporates and, spending a lot of budget into modern day training. And one thing that back then, I mean, now I realize that this is essentially one of the building blocks of SoSafe. Usually as a consultant, you walk through every client, every 1-3 months. So every 1-3 months, you change your client and you change your project. And then in most larger corporates, you have to go through mandatory training if you are an external consultant coming in. And that's what I did a lot of times. So doing this mandatory training, right? The, financial compliance, anti-money laundry, a little bit of data privacy, security, not so much back then, because it obviously wasn't a big topic on the company side. But I remember that I had to go through all these trainings. And as a psychologist, I also learned about learning psychology. I mean, it was totally clear to me, but I never questioned it. It was just a waste of time because, you just click through these questions and through these videos you watch. And it's just a huge waste of time, but everybody does it because they want to have their compliance checkbox. And that was also one of the motivating factors for SoSafe, because in security training for a long time, this was also the standard paradigm.
Okay. And then what was the so-called point of no return in which you were like, I need to start something on my own and I need to resolve this problem? By the way, I just want to say hello to you guys. I'm smart, by the way. I see it on my phone, so I can see who's cool. In the comment, right? So Stuka is saying hello from Zurich. Then we have John joining us from Eindhoven. So thanks, guys, for watching. Make sure to post your question to the stream if you have any questions to Nicholas. And then coming back to the question, Nicholas, what was the reason? What was the point of no return in which it's like, hey, I need to start something. I have these partners. And maybe if you can lead us through the story, what were you thinking you wanted to do and what are you doing actually today?
Yeah. So the point of no return eventually was when we all quit our jobs, right? So I met my co-founders, I met Lucas, I met Felix. By the way, you talked about BCG or McKinsey, who's number one? We don't know. I won't go into that. Lucas worked at McKinsey at that time. So this is also an example of yes, we can be friends. And then Felix was a freelancer. He's a typical whiz kid, started coding at the age of 12, being just very very tech savvy. And we got together because we wanted to build something, and that was something I wanted to do for a long time. At the point where I really quit my job, I technically also already thought a little bit, maybe I'm too old for that, because building a company, going into that risk, doing that leap of faith, I mean, this is also something that people usually do in their studies, right? You know, the typical startup story starts in a student dorm. But we got together because we were connected through that strong wish of building something, and of building something that is not any, you know, like any type of like bullshit model. So we looked at various models, but we dismissed them because eventually they weren't solving a real problem. And one of the problems we were initially looking at was corporate health management. So we really liked the idea of helping people change their behavior, building habits in order to be healthy, right? And because companies, they are in a war for talent, they are looking at, you know, a workforce that gets older. We thought that's a cool problem to solve for companies. But then we also realized that this pain of, not healthy employees, it's very far away for companies. So there's usually not a lot of immediate budget connected to that. And so that was a little bit of a frustrating experience where we realized that the problem was acknowledged as a real problem, but companies weren't really translating that into money or into revenue or into investments. So we sat together again and said, okay, we really like the idea of prevention. So preventing something that's bad, helping companies essentially also to save jobs, and doing that by upskilling people and by helping them to develop these habits. The only problem, the pain is not immediate enough. So where is the pain more immediate? And then quickly you come across cybercrime. And this is like 6 years ago where we first like thought about the idea, or like five years ago. So phishing was already a problem. Ransomware was already a problem. You know, like when your data gets encrypted and you have to pay Bitcoin in order to release it. That was already going on for quite some time. But on the company side, it wasn't really realized as that huge problem that it is nowadays. It was already a big problem, but companies didn't really know. So we got in at a very, very fortunate point in time. And took all these experience we had. So me going through that mandatory training. Then we also, you know, like, and we said, okay, this mandatory training that is the standard in most companies currently, this doesn't really do the trick. It doesn't help people change their behavior. It doesn't help people build secure habits. So we can apply psychology and behavioral science to actually do that better, to make it also pleasant, because most people hate those mandatory trainings. And another element was, you know, attack simulations, because our platform nowadays is doing phishing simulations. And this is something, so we send a phishing email. It's not a dangerous one. If you click on it, you get a little, you know, learning nugget where you understand, okay, how could you have recognized that mail? And then you learn for the real situation. And this is something that companies had done before, but more as a test. So they just tested their staff. So, you fell for this phishing email, and now we know you clicked on it. You're too stupid. And we said, okay, this is not the right approach to work with people building secure habits. We need to make it more friendly. So we need to do it anonymous. We need to do it continuous. And we need to connect it to a learning moment. And that's also what we did. So we took all these hypotheses or learnings from research, from psychology, and merged it into this platform that is now SoSafe, the SoSafe awareness platform, that really can, and you can show it to customers, that's the cool thing, that we can actually reduce the risk, maintain the risk on a lower level, help people to build these secure habits. And it's also fun for them, because that's another thing we are monitoring. We're developing our platform based on end user engagement.
Thanks for sharing, Niklas. And this podcast is obviously always kind of focused on the audience and the learnings, and you're already providing a lot of learnings. And I want to dive deeper into this entrepreneurial kind of journey. How long did it take you guys to realize, maybe I'm going to use the metaphor that former guest shared with me, Christo Borisov, the founder of the first Bulgarian unicorn company, Payhawk, when he came on the podcast, he said, you have to find and produce painkillers and not vitamins, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, the nice to have, it's cool, but maybe that's not something that's budgeted Exactly. So how long did it take you to figure this out? Like, could you have done it earlier if you go backwards now? And when was the time that you guys really started growing?
Yeah. Essentially, we grew always very steep from the start on, from day on. So that was also important for us that we could create revenue very, very early on, because that for us as founders was a, you know, a testament to that we are saving a relevant problem and we're saving it in a good way. And you're talking about the vitamins versus a medicine or painkiller discussion. This is something we have discussed a lot, also with investors 5 years ago, because in my point of view, the whole security industry changed their mindset. So if we go back 10 years ago, the paradigm of security professionals was, oh my God, the weakest link. People are always making these mistakes and they will never learn. Let's find ways of circumventing them. So install technological barriers, you know, like a spam filter. I mean, let's take the phishing email example. We install a spam filter, we install a firewall, you know, all these technological barriers that lead to a hypothetical situation where people can't do anything wrong. But this is a very theoretical consideration. And in my point of view, as a psychologist, this is only a very naive wish. So you can't circumvent people because the attackers, they are leveraging people. They are acknowledging that people are a very, very efficient way into the systems of companies. And this will stay like this forever. If you install one barrier, attackers will find a way around it. And I have a story for that in a second, which is quite cool. But this was the paradigm 10 years ago. And then there was more regulation coming saying, okay, you need to train your people, you need to instruct your people. And the second wave was more, okay, then let's do just compliance. Okay, here's the policy. Stojan, please, you sign the policy. You understand the policy. Watch this 90-minute video here, and then we're done. And because, I mean, that's easy, and that's how maybe very technological profiles look at humans. And now we are in a world where, and we have actively shaped that too, but it's very good to see that most security professionals have adopted that as well, that mindset change to, damn, we need to work with the people on a constant level, because attackers are also working with the people on a constant level. And to give you one example, how this is currently shaping security, and I think I talked about that on Web Summit as well, the Grand Theft Auto story. So I don't know. Have you played GTA in the past?
Yes, but it was 10 years ago. So I'm
yeah, me too. Me too.
One of the early versions that was 2D kind of like.
I also only played GTA Vice City. So that's 17 years old or 18 years old. And I loved this because, you know, like it was set in Miami. There were palm trees. You know, it was, you know, just a cool vibe. It felt like, you know, Miami Vice. And it's a very old game. And I always wanted to have the new installment of GTA set in Vice City, so set in Miami again. And last year, I was very happy because now we know that the next part of that series will be set again. Why do we know that? Not because they published it, because they got hacked. So Rockstar Games, the publisher, got hacked by the same hacking group that also hacked Uber. So very, very, you know, huge and secure companies. And how did they do that? They actually realized that Uber or Rockstar Games had installed multi-factor authentication. So here, you know, you log into a website, you log into a tool, and then you have to, you know, click or put in a token of multi-factor authentication. You have done that. I hope you have everything on multi-factor because it's a very important security measure. But there's some, and this is how Uber had it actually. You could enter a multi-factor token via text messages. So you would get a request and enter a text message, and then you would get in. So these hackers, they stole credentials, passwords, and usernames, but they needed the multi-factor tokens. So what did they do? They also stole the cell phone numbers, and then they sent a request, but nobody reacted to the request because nobody just logged in. But they realized, people don't like to get annoyed. So they sent up to 20, 30 requests, and then everyone eventually entered that token. So they really got into our minds and circumvented a technological barrier that was installed to actually exclude people, but they again used people to circumvent this technological barrier. So you need to work with people and tell them about these tactics, and there will be constant innovation from the hackers.
Fascinating, man. Fascinating. Yes. Thanks for sharing this story. And we're going to go into all security and cyber and these kind of things, the second part of the conversation. I just want to get back to your own journey as an entrepreneur first. And if you can maybe lead us through your personal journey, meaning from a psychologist to a consultant to now having to be the entrepreneur, the founder, and you know, those of you listening who never been in entrepreneurship, it's a very interesting journey. We don't really talk much about the darker side of the journey. Like, you see all these stories of the unicorn founders and successes, but I think we need to talk a lot more about the real journey. Like, because when you're a founder, it's all on you, right? You're the last person in command. Whatever happens, it's on you. You not only have to build a great product and find customers, but you're everywhere, right? And you have to hire people, you have to manage people. So you have to be really self-organized and lead everybody, like by example, but then you have to be there for everybody else. So I wonder, what was it for you joining this a lot more environment of uncertainty and you know, learning to navigate in uncertainty? How did you adapt to this environment?
Many questions. Let me dissect it a little bit. So, I mean, your first part of the question was how was the journey from, you know, psychologist, consultant to entrepreneur? And I would say the path was, the Pareto path, the 80-20 path, because you, as a psychologist, essentially what they do, they train you to become a very good scientist, a very good researcher. And that's something you need to, you know, wiggle a little bit off in consulting, because there's a lot of time pressure and you have to be thorough, but you also have to be time efficient. So that's something you learn there by, you know, hard lessons, working long hours and, you know, eventually getting efficient. But still, when I compare this to the especially the first part of the startup phase, where you are like 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 people, you need to be very, very, you know, quick and dirty, or MVP style. So think big, start small. That's also something that we try to adopt here now in our organization. And I think this is also, then if you look at the journey within an organization, and we are not a very typical one, or we are one of very few, we grew very, very fast. So we are 4.5 years old, 350 people. So and I have Laura from our head of PR gave me the numbers, because it sometimes you even forget this. So we were 100 people at the end of 2020, or like I think 90 people, then 180 at the end of 21, and then now 350. So this is so steep growth that your job is constantly changing. And, you know, one part, as I mentioned, is this, you know, getting, embracing a little bit more of that think big, start small spirit. I think that's super important. Then another thing that I'm a huge fan of Horowitz, his book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things, where he calls it the struggle, right? It's a constant struggle, also the emotional part, getting back to that in a second. And nowadays, as the CEO of a 350 people company, I regard myself more, the main part is being a recruiter. So my job is to hire the best talent, to get the best leaders we can get there in the world, to shape the organization, or to help shape the organization, and also listen and explain. Right. That's for employees, that's for customers, that's for software analysts, for investors as well, obviously. So your job changes constantly to the situation that I am in now. It's probably every 3 months a new job.
And that's what I'm sure many people are curious about. Like, how do you decide what to focus on today? Like, do you have any, you know, any kind of, like, you sit on Sunday and you look at the whole thing and where should my focus be? Like, how do you decide what to spend your time on?
That's a good question. I mean, for me, at the current point in time, roughly, it's that split I just mentioned. So a lot on building the organization. And then usually as a founder, as an entrepreneur, as a CEO, you are, I mean, the two most important things are, you know, revenue and capitalization. Luckily, we are in a very good situation. And getting back to that vitamin versus painkiller discussion, it is very clear that we are a very essential painkiller category in security even. So we are also very robust in terms of the economic climate, because companies are investing, they're increasing their investments in our category. So these usually very, very, you know, tough problems, I currently don't have to focus on so much. So I can focus more on building the organization, helping to shape the organization. And this is what currently is my focus point. Obviously, the various parts of our organization have different areas to focus on, but they are all aligned under one vision, under one long-term strategy. This is also something we developed while growing up. So 1 year ago or 2 years ago, we weren't on that maturity stage, but now we are doing all these things like OKRs and having, you know, regular strategy cycles and all these things to create alignment and cross collaboration. And we decide together where to focus on.
I just want to make sure that doesn't just, you know, slip out very quickly. Like, I think it's a very important point. You said I focus on revenue and capitalization. So and I think that's a very important to anybody listening, especially early stage founders, right? Like, is that for you kind of a North Star to pre-screen whether I should spend my time on these things? Like,
and in that order, it's very important. Okay. So $1 of revenue is always much, much, much more important than $1 of raised capital, right?
Okay.
And I mean,
I'll let that sink.
I mean, you could be in a crazy, I don't know, B2C app model where, you know, there will be a long path until monetization. I don't know. It feels to me that, and I can only speak for B2B and especially B2B SaaS. And there, it should be always your focus. I mean, not because you need to be a capitalist or something like that, but, you know, you want to solve a problem that is a real problem, and you want to solve it in a, you know, in a way that is better than the existing solutions or competitive products. And the best metric for that is recurring revenue. And so for any founder, and that's how we did it as well, in the very beginning, focus on that. Because if nobody wants to pay for your solution, probably it's a bad solution or you're not solving the right problem.
We had a Hollywood cinematographer joining us on the podcast, Shane Herbert. Everybody should go listen to this podcast as well. It's a great episode. And he was sharing productivity lessons from the movie industry. And the guy, he worked on Terminator Salvation, Need for Speed. Wow. Like, you know, he's one of the top guys out there. And I mean, talk about leadership. And I asked him, what are your challenges as a director of photography? And he said, "Stoyan, my biggest challenge as a leader is to make sure that every person from my team is making the same movie."
Oh yeah, yeah. That's talking about alignment and vision, right?
That's my question to you. Like one thing is you and your co-founders to be on the same page, but how do you make sure that everybody's on the same page? So you guys are focused on the same priorities. You guys are clear. Can you share some practical ideas for our listeners?
Yeah. By the way, I will have to watch that episode, because that was my goal before I went into psychology. I wanted to be a filmmaker, and I also spent some time on movie sets working as a set runner. You know, actually the lowest part in the food chain in the movie industry.
The coffee maker.
Coffee maker. Watch the truck. You know, and get up at 3 a.m. So I had like 25 hour days, working days, and. And this was probably the toughest experience work-wise in my life, even tougher than consulting. So, the vision, the alignment. I mean, this obviously changes also through the stages. In the beginning, it's very easy. I mean, if we go back to those days where we were three people, so Felix, you know, he would code the product. I would come back from customer interviews or sales calls, tell him, you know, like we were discussing about how should the product look like. And Lucas was actually in product management back then. But obviously in a company of our size and dynamics, our answer is to have a more or less structured process. So we have a regular cadence throughout the year where we, you know, in the beginning set up a 12 to 18 month strategy, broken down into the various parts. So the go-to-market part, the product part, our new CPO, Gigi, Gonzalo Gayolas, who used to be the CPO of OutSystems, you know, the biggest scale up and success story in Portugal. What he did very quickly in the beginning, he developed a showroom of our 18 months product as of now to make it very real. So you can go in there and you can actually interact with the product of the future. So this is something that helps very much to make it tangible and to, I mean, not answer all those detailed questions, but to actually empower and enable the product managers to make all those micro decisions based on a, you know, more or less tangible future. And this is just one example.
And do you have any special SoulSafe team practices that maybe you through trial and error figure out that work for an organization with 350 people who are split into different places around the world?
What do you mean, like in like collaboration or?
Yeah, like communication, or like you have these special meetings where you discuss special things, or like some of these more practical operational things that tend to work for you.
It's, I think, and I mean, we are a hybrid first company. We grew when COVID broke out, essentially. So I almost can't remember how it is. Well, I can remember, but it seems like very long ago that we were sitting all together in one office. So we try to embrace really that hybrid work setting. And that, for me, that means two things. The first thing is you will have to over-communicate. So sometimes it's a little bit less efficient because you need to communicate more. You need to, you know, set up more, not more meetings, but make sure that everybody gets the information that he or she needs. Also, and this is connected to the second point, casual and informal interaction is very hard to do. So, I mean, you can set up a coffee call, and we also do that. We have coffee chat slots. You can also, every employee can book a coffee chat with me and with all the other senior leaders. But it's a different thing than to really meet at the coffee machine, because that will be more informal. So the second thing that we do is to also stimulate get-togethers. So we are not forcing anyone to the office. So it's all super flexible, and this is, I think, at the core of what we believe around hybrid work. But we try to stimulate it a little bit. One aspect is our quarterly cycle of strategy weeks, where the entire mid-level leadership comes here to our headquarter. We discuss, you know, our challenges. We talk about OKRs for the next quarter, and we also encourage these leaders to get their teams also to the office. And that's something that you almost can't buy with money, because you know, that exchange on the informal level here on our rooftop, people from various departments talking to each other, that's where really, really cool solutions and creative ideas come from. And that's a challenge in a hybrid setting, or even more in an entirely remote setting.
Yeah, just to share one more strategy, it's probably for smaller teams, but last week I was coaching a startup, and I'm so sorry I can't mention the name because I need to double check which was it, but I'll post it in the comments to give them credit. But the founder shared with me, because they're fully remote, small team, probably 10 people, but for them to kind of get to know each other, many of them are IT people, he came up with this I think he calls them green coffee or something, where he sets up people in pairs, and every week it's mandatory. You have to drink 15-minute coffee with one of your coworkers. There's no rules. Just you have to spend 15 minutes to have coffee and talk. You need to do that even for the IT people.
We had that in the beginning too. Like when COVID broke out, we introduced something we called coffee chat roulette. So you were also, I think it wasn't mandatory, but many people signed up for it. And then we would mix people together and have them over lunch or like right after lunch break, they would be, you know, put together to have a coffee chat.
Yeah, but you have to create, right? You have to innovate. You have to see what works for you. Test because I mean nobody knows how to deal with it. It's like, you know, remote, hybrid, many countries. Like you have to innovate, right? But Nicholas, let's maybe get back to the topic that we briefly touched, and it's the topic of dealing with struggles and challenges. And once again, I look at you now. Some people see you for the first time listening to the podcast, and they're like, man, this Nicholas guy, he has it all figured out. He's so calm. He has this, you know, background. He's coming from BCG, McKinsey, his co-founder, 4.5 years, 350 people. They raise funding. They, you know, he's calm. Nothing bad happens to him, right? Like, tell me the real story. Like, do you have any examples and stories you can share? Maybe like, you know, stories of struggle, challenges, maybe a crisis, even near death experience, if you may, and what were your learnings and, you know, advice to people who are dealing with difficult times?
Well, I mean, first of all, luckily, I think, I mean, you're talking about near death experiences. Luckily, we never experienced anything like that. And but maybe it's also a matter of your own mindset. And you know, I pretty much changed it already at the beginning. So I mentioned this initial story where we wanted to go in that corporate health management space, and it didn't really work out. And I already quit my job. So it felt for me like I really messed up my life, which was not true because I still, you know, I had this pretty cool label of BCG in my CV. And, you know, I knew that this was not existential. Still, I felt very bad. It was emotionally one of the toughest phases in my life. I didn't sleep for 2 weeks, which is technically impossible, but it felt like really I didn't sleep. But this also put me in a situation, or put us all, because Felix and Lucas, they were obviously also struggling with that, put us together in this situation where we had nothing to lose anymore. And that sparked a lot of creativity, sparked a lot of motivation. And so seeing also the positive things in the struggle, that's very important. And maybe that also prepared us for the different challenges to come, because obviously, and again, Horowitz is putting it very well when he says, the struggle can, it's very hard to explain the struggle, that emotional up and down of a founder and also of a management team of a scale up. It's very hard to explain because there will be always in a constant way challenges and will be an up and down. Changing your mindset a little bit more is very, very important. And to also, what helps me is to see the learning opportunity in also the challenges. And obviously, I mean, if you look at our scaling, you know, putting 150 people on top of 100 within 1 year, obviously that will lead to some growing pains. You know, people that realize, oh, this is not the company anymore that I signed in one year ago or 1.5 years ago. And then you have to deal with it. You have to talk to people. You have to explain. You have to listen. But maybe there will be also some people where in a discussion you come to the conclusion this doesn't fit anymore on both sides. And this is a tough also emotional challenge. But embracing this as a learning opportunity is also one of our core values here at SoSafe, that we obviously try to put learning in our product. I mean, in our product, learning is the core. So we also put learning at the center of our personal development. This is something we, for example, also do on the executive team. If there's a challenge, to see the learning opportunity, because then nothing can really get you, right? Because you will learn from everything.
And since you started speaking about some of your values and you know, employees, I want to maybe lead the conversation into that. One of our recent guests was the first chief HR officer of LinkedIn. Mm. And he was hired when the company was 300-400 people. and not having much of funding, but trying to compete for talent. And for 3.5 years, they grew to 4,000 people. And he shared with me some tactics and strategies that they were using in order to attract the best people when they don't have the budget. Now, I don't know how's the situation with you guys, but again, you've been growing really, really fast. And you said your priority is to get the top people. So can you maybe tell me some ideas of how do you attract great people when you are not Google or Facebook? And just to remind, because I know Laura from the PR team is probably going to say, hey, Nicholas, we have 40 open positions. So I want to remind you and those of you who are listening.
I also wanted to highlight here now the little job advertising block. Indeed, we are hiring 40 open positions across the board. So you don't have to be a security specialist. We're hiring in all different positions, even in product. We have many positions where you don't have to come from cybersecurity, but you can make your first steps into cybersecurity. We are also, by the way, Stojan, that's cool that you mentioned that we are currently also hiring a chief people officer. So if you know, one of those great HR and people leaders out there, we are hiring for exactly that journey, 350 people to, I don't know, plus. How can we get people? I think we have a little bit of an unfair advantage in hiring. And one is obviously that we are very robust. I mean, there's obviously many tech companies struggling at the moment. This is, cybersecurity and especially our category is very robust. So that's also something. But for me, it's more, purpose and the personal mission and changing the world for the better gets increasingly important for literally everyone. I don't like that Generation Z discussion because I think also for me, it was important back then when I started my job. So doing something meaningful is important to most people. And in our case, it's super rewarding because we are on the one hand decreasing a huge problem. So the World Economic Forum says cybercrime is the most dangerous threat, so the top one threat to the global economy or technological threat to the global economy. I mean, pandemics and global warming are only the ones that are even higher. So we are really decreasing this effect cybercrime has on the global economy, saving jobs, saving even lives. In Germany, we had a fatal case of a patient in a hospital that got hacked and she died because of that, because they had to close the emergency room. So you're really helping people, you're protecting people, and you are doing that by helping people, helping humans to increase their self-defense skills. And if you have ever talked to a victim of cybercrime, be it in a company, so somebody who clicked on a phishing email and then that company is offline for weeks, or even a private victim, I talked to many of them, that got scammed, by Roman scam. We all watched the Tinder swindler and it, feels like, it's maybe even a little bit entertaining. It's not. For those victims, it's devastating. And they're never the same people again after they fell for a cybercrime attack. And we are helping these people by upskilling them, by teaching them something to really not become a victim. And this is, in my point of view, a very unfair advantage on the recruiting market because I'm getting goosebumps here. This is a very, very, very compelling mission for most people that I know. And then a part of that, we're obviously also a modern company and growing and, have all the cool perks. We're not Google, but we're maybe, a cozy little version of Google. No, cozy, definitely not. We are also a performance-driven company. That's very important for us that we say we're not a family, but we are like a sports team, right? If you really want to achieve something, then SoSafe will be for you. And while doing so, you are helping people to get a little bit more cyber smart.
And for those of you listening who maybe your mission or purpose is not so clear, obviously in the case of SoSafe, it's much easier to define it, but you can always go and dig deeper and find it. My accountant, if you go to his webpage, the first thing you see there is, I help small business owners sleep better at night. So it's like he's not an accountant. You know, mm-hmm. he's using a he's fired up. Klaus, if you're watching, thank you for having my back for over 5-6 years now. But like, it's not an accident, by the way, Nicholas, that yesterday we talked about the perform methodology and the core of our book, right? Perform. The first letter is purpose and values.
Yeah,
it's not because it's like Simon Sinek said it, and you know, it's because it's actually very practical. When you're very clear what's the mission, what's the purpose, you'll be a lot more likely to attract great people, to excite investors, to excite customers, if you truly authentically believe in the purpose. So whoever you are out there, you know, make sure to get clear and communicate this purpose. But I want to get, we have a really good question coming from one of our listeners, Momchil. Momchil, thank you for being with us and for the great question. So the question is, hey, Nicholas, one question I think is quite relevant nowadays. How do you manage the daily emotional and psychological challenges when managing a company and your personal life?
It's a very relevant question. And I really regret that I never did this, because there used to be a LinkedIn post. Unfortunately, I can't find it anymore. Where various founders, like they drew the emotional state over, you know, like on a weekly basis. And then you can see that up and down, you know, fundraising doesn't work. And then they crash. And I always wanted to do that, but I never did it. But looking back, obviously, it was quite a weekly up and down. You know, for me, I also look back into what I learned in psychology. So the solid foundation of emotional stability is obviously also a good health, right? So I really got into very regular exercising. I do usually sports every day, but just very small, like just very short. So 20 minutes of, you know, body weight training in the morning. I never thought I could do that, because I always said, I'm not a morning person. And I'm not, but it helps me being much more stable and happy throughout the day. So this really works. A lot of sleep. You can see it maybe a little bit, because it's super hot here currently in Cologne. I didn't sleep very well last night. So that's also a very, very important thing. And then humans are social beings. So I mentioned my co-founders. I mentioned the senior management we have here and the whole group of safies we have at SoSafe. Talking about that and supporting you in the tougher times, that's also a very important thing. I really admire and have the greatest respect for solo founders. I found for myself that being not a solo founder is really a protection factor. So, I mean, greatest respect, but if you are in that very early phase together, and we had been three people, you know, in that insecurity and you know, also the decisions we need to make, it felt better in a group of people. We also had our first payroll employee, Tore, which is also one of my closest friends, also another former BCG colleague. He was there very, very early on as well. So that also helps a lot if you have people. And, you know, a family coping system, how we call it in psychology, is also important, that your family is supporting you and you have somebody to talk to. Oh yeah, and maybe one very important aspect, mental health. This is obviously very, very important to me personally, but also to us here at SoSafe in general. We just rolled out you know, one of those programs where you can talk to a psychologist anytime. I think that's a great opportunity to do that, because sometimes even the public health systems cannot really deliver that. In Germany, this is the case, for example. And another thing, and I'm not going to go into that too deep, but we just published our human risk review, which is our, you know, flagship report where we look at the top security trends. And one of those trends is burnout and mental health in cybersecurity professionals, because these people are under a lot of constant stress. So if you want to find out what's about that, dig a bit deeper in our report.
Go check it out, guys. And let's maybe talk a little bit about you. You mentioned a few stories already and examples, but I want to go deeper into, you know, I know you have a bigger understanding now. You guys collect a lot of data about all the security threats. And I don't know much about it. I'm sure many of the listeners have no idea about it. and usually people start looking into it when they get into trouble, right? I mean, my Facebook account got hacked a couple of years ago. I couldn't reclaim it because Facebook support is not really great. For six months, I couldn't reclaim it, so I made a new one. But it's a small thing, right? It's a Facebook account. But what are some of the biggest threats and trends that are happening in 2023? Can you give us just an overview so even people who do not decide to work with you guys can at least get a bit of a sense of what they should pay attention to?
Yeah, it's still over the last, I think, 3 to 5 years, we have one constant factor, and this is not a marketing claim. It's not only in our research, it's also in official government research and government numbers. The German Federal Cybersecurity Agency also publishes that number. 9 out of 10 cyber attacks involve the human layer. So, I mean, this is maybe something we need to let this sink in, because technically people think cybercrime or cyber attacks are a very technological act, right? Somebody hacking into the system of a company. In most cases, 9 out of 10, almost 9 out of 10, it starts with a phishing email. So email phishing is still the go-to thing that every hacker will use probably at the beginning. We had one very, very famous hacker, Jamie Woodroff, on our last Human Firewall conference, which is our cornerstone conference. And that's the guy who hacked the Instagram account of Kim Kardashian. So you are in good company, Stojan. So he hacked the account, but he's also a so-called white hat hacker. So he gets paid by companies so that he hacks these companies and he tells them the weaknesses, the loopholes. And he said, employees are your first and last line of defense, because what he does in the very beginning is usually something around the human layer, manipulating people by phishing emails. Or in this one case, he also he actually started at one pizza chain and delivered pizza into a bank, because he saw always going like pizza delivery guys going into that bank at the same point of time. And then he went in there and installed some hardware to extract data. So this is a trend that is at the core. So it's, you know, all these things: phishing, ransomware, so encrypting of data, and then you have to pay cryptocurrencies to get your data back, is still what we see. We see huge drivers from the geopolitical situation. So we're living in a fragmented world. Last week, I had a very interesting webinar with Katrin Suder, who used to be the state secretary in the defense ministry in Germany. So she also talks about this ever fragmenting world. So, you know, globalization is decreasing, and this is actually increasing cybercrime. I talked about the circumvention of tech barriers, so multi-factor authentication failing, again, the human layer. And then there is AI. And I've been talking about the so-called weaponization of AI for over 4 years. So 4 years ago, we published a research paper and I gave a talk about voice cloning. And now I don't need to explain that anymore. 4 years ago, I needed to explain that very well. So it's, you know, AI models that can imitate your voice. We all know those funny videos on Instagram where Trump is talking to Biden and all these things. But it can also be used for social engineering, and it is used for social engineering. So we know of cases. I think 2 years ago, 35 million euros were wire transferred by a company that received a call using a voice cloning model. So the CEO called and the voice of the CEO said, okay, you need to do this wire transfer. And this is something that people sometimes think this is still science fiction, but it's not. It's already being used by cyber criminals. So we need to get aware of, you know, deep fakes is another topic. That's something we talk about in the media. But one thing that really scares me is, and this seems to be starting, is the usage of large language models like ChatGPT or the open source ones of Facebook, for example, for so-called spear phishing. So you can just get in some, you know, public personal data from you, Stojan, and then these models can create very, very convincing phishing emails and talk to you via email. And we tested it at SoSafe in our report, and we already see very high click rates. So it's very convincing if you have a large language model write phishing emails. And if you just apply some criminal fantasy to that, there will be waves and waves of extremely well-written phishing emails coming to us, because currently the standard phishing email is still very, you know, badly made. Or badly written. So this is something that we see as a huge trend. And again, we need to familiarize our staff and our people with these new attacks, which we are, for example, also doing with a chatbot. So also with a conversational interface. Sophie, it's like a nice bot that is interacting with you and warning you against the latest tactics.
Maybe can you summarize this series, like, for the people listening, maybe managers in companies or founders, entrepreneurs? What would be the main awareness areas their employees should be aware of?
Unfortunately, this is a question I get many times. So what are the five tips you can give? Obviously, this also changes, right? So I don't know. 3 years ago, I was saying, okay, use a password manager, roll out a password manager. But the situation has become so volatile, so dynamic, that these tips that I need to give are constantly changing. That's also why over 3,000 companies or 4,000 companies are using our platform. Because they get more dynamic training and dynamic awareness creation for their employees. And it's less about, hey, here are the five tips. It's more about creating a security culture that stays on top of the game. And so obviously it's you know, don't click on a phishing email, but report a phishing email to your security team. But how do you do that? You need to train for that. And that's why we are also constantly doing our phishing simulation, because it creates that gut feeling in your employees for those ever-changing new attacks that are coming up every, you know, every week, essentially.
So do you guys train both the security teams of companies and the staff?
Everyone, yes.
Can you tell me just as you know, the last few minutes, more about the platform and who would be people or like companies that will most benefit from using your platform?
So the last part, very easy. It's every company. And this is also, if you look at cybersecurity regulation, then essentially every company needs to invest into cybersecurity, because it's a constant threat level that will remain. Some people even call it a digital tax. So even small companies, but obviously also very big companies, are within the target range of cyber criminals, because the attacking industry is also very differentiated. There's some that only attack large companies. There's some that attack small companies. So every company actually needs to invest, and also needs to invest in the human layer. Now in Europe, there's even a regulation saying that management will be liable if they don't invest. So they even can, you know, be sued for that. So it's every kind of company, and our platform pretty much does what you know from learning psychology. So we teach people something. That's also how we call the module, the teach module. It delivers the knowledge, but in a very fun, interactive way. We have characters, you click on things, it's gamified. You can, you know, collect badges and points, you know, everything that we know from nowadays modern learning. Then we train. That's the second module, where we have this attack simulation and you react to simulated attacks. And again, we tell you, if you fall for it, how can you prevent it in the future? So you actively learn something. People love that because they learn without being learning. And then we have a reporting infrastructure. So it's a small tool where you can check, for example, emails, and it gives you a little bit of a risk indicator and guides you through that email, and you can report it to your security team. And especially that part is a very good measure for the so-called posture or resilience of a company, because if your employees and our most successful customers have like 85 to 90% reporting rate, so 90% of all your people are constantly reporting possible threats and attacks, then this decreases your risk. And this is something you can show to your board, to your top management, to your advisory board, who is also increasingly interested in security. I can tell you, this is increasingly being discussed in on board level.
And I just posted the link. You can see it on the screen if you're watching the video version of this podcast. SoSafe-awareness.com. So you can go check out how the platform works and everything about it. And just to for the final kind of summary, can you remind everybody about, I mean, you guys are growing now, 350 people plus, and you're hiring 40 plus people. I don't know how many, but tell us about the positions once again. Who can apply? Where should they be located? And what are the kind of positions you're looking for targeting? Yeah.
So location-wise, we're remote or like hybrid. So it doesn't matter where you are, at least within a certain time zone corridor. So we are a European company, headquartered in Germany, have offices in Cologne and Berlin, but also London, Paris, and Amsterdam. More to come. And then it's all kind of positions. It's in sales, SDRs. If you want to enter the world of cybersecurity in sales, we are looking very, very intensively there, but also in engineering, in product management, in many, many parts of the organization. We are looking HR and people. So have a look at our career website. You can also see a little bit more about our culture here, and some very, very tangible examples of safeties of our colleagues, and just have a look at the open positions.
Thank you so much, Nicholas. Thanks, everybody, for being with us, watching live, engaging. And for those of you listening to the podcast, if you only watch this episode or listen to this episode, make sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube to Productivity Mastery, and listen to conversations with people like Nicholas, people like the founder of Reebok, the president of Starbucks, top-tier executives, unicorn founders, authors, I mean, you name it, and, you know, get inspired. And obviously, don't just get inspired, go out and do stuff with this knowledge, you know, otherwise it just stays there, right? But yeah, I mean, make sure to share this episode with a friend, with your neighbor, with your grandmother, if she needs some cybersecurity advice. And
very important, very, no, really, really, really.
By the way, they're the one that gets phished the most, right?
So many examples. We actually have numbers that younger people are getting phished more than older people, but it's important. my dad usually sends me a little photo of his cell phone saying this is a phishing SMS. He knows how to spot phishing.
That's very important. Excellent. Thank you so much, Nicholas. Thanks, everybody, and see you once again at the next episode of Productivity Mastery. Thank you guys for listening. Make sure to subscribe to my monthly newsletter by visiting stojanjankov.com, and also learn about the Perform methodology and the Perform book, as well as our various personal and team coaching offers. Stay tuned and keep performing.